From KRCB in Santa Rosa, it's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour with Michelle Anna Jordan.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the dairy families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont. On the web at go.coop.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out
door. Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Tonight we have a special holiday edition of Mouthful. Last September, as part of the Russian River Food and Wine Fest, Pegasus Theater hosted something called Table Talk. It was a really lively evening of memorable food moments from primarily from film and literature. It was brought to life by the Pegasus Players and was a benefit for Pegasus Theater. The whole thing was hosted by that force of nature, our very own Clark Wolf.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is Pegasus and Table Talk. It is a part of this year's 2007 Russian River Food and Wine Fest. The reason for the Food and Wine Fest, as started by myself and Scott Mitchell, is to help in our community bring attention to those jewels that are perhaps slightly under-discovered. And so we thought it would be kind of fun to share with you some of the greatest words about food and what we eat and drink. I'm going to introduce now 3 readings. The first is from a guy who in the 20th century wrote a really amazing autobiography about his life. His name is James Beard. And I was fortunate enough to know him a bit. I had a cheese shop at the base of Knob Hill. And one day the door darkened and there was this 350-pound man in a black leather trench coat from the floor to Knob Hill. And he came lumbering in and said, "Hello, I'm James Beard. No fooling, bud." You know, he's like, "I get it." And he bought some cheeses that his doctor said he shouldn't have. And when I was fortunate enough to move to New York in early 1982, he fed me once a week to make sure I ate. Not such a bad way to be. He was a force and a voice for American food that we find as fresh and as modern today as he ever was then. West Coast boy. And he wrote an autobiography that really sums it up. It was called, and it is called, because it's very much alive, Delights and Prejudices. Delights and Prejudices, because things delight us and we're very strong in our feelings about all kinds of stuff, especially what we eat and drink. The second reading is a very touching piece by David Masumoto that Jacqueline Wells will read from Epitaph for a Peach. And the third, Mo McElroy will read a little something from Like Water for Chocolate by Laura Esquivel. And then after intermission, we have a second act, a short second act, and our supper at the end will feature some delicious food. Among that food will be some amazing and legendary biscuits baked by and made by hand by Scott Peacock from Atlanta, Georgia, who's out there in the audience as well. Let's hear it for Scott. Scott Peacock is a gift to us in America. He, with Edna Lewis, wrote The Gift of Southern Cooking, and he is a cook of the first order in Atlanta, Georgia, who just won the James Beard Award for his region, and who is a young fella who's going to be cooking for us for many years to come. So first, we begin with Paul Huberty from Delights and Prejudices.
When Proust recollected the precise taste sensation of the little scalloped Madeleine cake served at tea by his aunt, it led him into his monumental remembrance of things past. But when I recollect the taste sensations of my childhood, they lead me to more cakes and more tastes, like the great razor clams, or the succulent Dungeness crab, or salmon, crawfish, mussels, and trout of the Oregon coast, or the black bottom pie served in a famous Portland restaurant, the Welsh rarebit of our Chinese cook, the white asparagus my mother canned. And the array of good dishes prepared by the two of them in that most memorable of kitchens, the kitchen. Reasonably enough, it was the scene of my first gastronomic adventure. I was on all fours. I crawled into the vegetable bin, settled on a giant onion, and ate it, skin and all. It must have marked me for life, for I've never ceased to love the hearty flavor of raw onions. And if my earliest love in food was onion, my earliest hate was milk. I loathed milk, cold or hot. It simply couldn't be made attractive to me as a drink. And if occasionally a zealous adult with standard notions about growing children forced me to drink a glass, I promptly became sick. It has never failed to be an effective emetic for me. I'm still revolted when I see a perfectly good meal being served with milk. Eventually, though, I came to accept milk when it was combined with other ingredients and turned into a modest but delectable clam soup. I grew to love this soup, served with a great toasted soda crackers. And in fact, for dessert, we would sneak down, have more of the crackers spread with butter and a bitter marmalade. Now, the ability to recall a taste sensation, which I think of as taste memory, is a God-given talent, akin to perfect pitch, which makes your life richer if you possess it. Sorry, if you aren't born with it, you can never seem to acquire it. Great wine palates must depend on taste memory for the sureness of their judgment, and a Lachine or a Schoonmaker without this memory would never be able to perform the almost overpowering task of comparing vintages and selecting wines. Cheese tasters, tea tasters, cognac tasters, all must depend for a living on the keenness of their taste memories. Great gastronomes also have a highly developed sense memory, or they would not be able to make such a ceremony of tasting and enjoying food. And naturally, good chefs and cooks must depend upon memory when they season or when they are combining subtle flavors to create that new dish or that new sauce. I think I developed an accurate taste memory early in my life. You see, I was not sentimentally attached to the cooking of any one person at home. We ate in restaurants a good deal. I tried to be as objective as possible about taste and was somewhat precocious in appreciating the pleasures of blending satisfying flavors. Now, while this meant that I learned to enjoy the delights of a good meal, it also meant that I soon grew intolerant of mediocre food. More than once, I'm afraid, my candid appraisals embarrassed a hostess or friends with whom we were sharing a meal. I often wonder why I didn't have a pie thrown at me more often. Now, not all taste memory is accurate. Many people think of mom's apple pie or grandmother's dumplings as delicacies that cannot be equaled today. These memories are associated with happy times, and to the untrained palate, the pie or the dumpling seemed delicious. If the same dishes were recreated and presented to a sophisticated palate, they would probably belie their reputations. Because, you see, most of the home cooking one enjoyed in his youth was not as good as one remembers it.
The last of my Suncrest peaches will be dug up. A bulldozer will be summoned to crawl into my fields, rip each tree from the earth, and toss it aside. The sounds of cracking limbs and splitting trunks will echo throughout the countryside. My orchard will topple easily, gobbled up by the power of the diesel engine and the fact that no one seems to want a peach variety with a wonderful taste. Yes, wonderful. Suncrest tastes like a peach is supposed to. As with many of the older varieties, the flesh is so juicy that it oozes down your chin. The nectar explodes in your mouth, and the fragrance enchants your nose, a natural perfume that can never be captured. Suncrest is one of the last remaining truly juicy peaches. When you wash that treasure under a stream of cooling water, your fingertips instinctively search for the gushy side of the fruit. Your mouth waters in anticipation. You lean over the sink to make sure you don't drip on yourself. Then you sink your teeth into the flesh, and the juice trickles down your cheeks and dangles on your chin. This is a real bite, a primal act, a magical sensory celebration announcing that summer has arrived. The experience of eating a Suncrest peach automatically triggers a smile and a rush of summer memories. Eating a Suncrest reminds us of the simple, savory pleasures of life. My dad planted our Suncrest orchard 20 years ago, and those trees paid for my college tuition. But now they are old and obsolete. Stricter and stricter quality standards coupled with declining demand cut deeply into our production levels. Our original 15 acres and 1,500 trees have been reduced to a patch of 350. I'm told these peaches have a problem. When ripe, they turn an amber gold rather than the lipstick red that seduces the public. Every year, the fruit brokers advise me to get rid of those old Suncrests. Better peaches have come along, they assure me. Peaches that are fuller in color and can last for weeks in storage. I have a recurring nightmare of cold storage rooms lined with peaches that stay rock hard. The new science of fruit cryonics, keeping peaches in suspended animation. There is no room there for my Suncrests. All of them rejected with the phrase, no shelf life, stamped in red across each box. Consumers love the new varieties, brokers advise. They'll abandon your old Suncrests. My sales returns at the end of each growing season confirm their comments. Demand remains weak, and I have to accept lower prices. But I can't give up. I often picture shoppers picking a Suncrest out of one of my boxes, not knowing the hidden treasure that awaits them. When they bite into it, they'll say, ah, this is a peach. I've been keeping those old peaches for years, rationalizing that it's worth hanging on to something that has meaning beyond mere monetary reward. But I'm scared. Scared because I can't sell my peaches. Thousands of boxes sit in storage, blacklisted with a bad reputation. Boxes that have been paid for. Fruit that cost me and my family a year's labor, wasted, unproductive, and impotent. Many family farmers with fruit varieties like Suncrest peaches no longer calculate how much they earn, but how much they owe. Can you imagine working an entire year and having your boss inform you that you owe him money? No matter what you believe, you can't farm for very long and only be rewarded with good-tasting peaches. This year will witness not only the possible death of this peach, but also the continuing slow extinction of the family farmer. A fruit variety is no longer valued, and a way of life is in peril. My work remains unrewarded. When I first started, I realized I would never make a fortune in farming, but I hoped I could be rich in other ways, and maybe, just maybe, my work would create some other kind of wealth in the process. Part of me knows I'll survive. The family farmer is a tough species, and we will find ways to continue. But when I think of that Suncrest orchard, it hurts to see a slice of my life ripped out, flavor lost along with meaning. Life will be different without Suncrest peaches, and with the loss of variety, consumers will be the ultimate losers. I envision my orchard yielding to the bulldozer and the trees tumbling without a fight. I imagine setting a match to them and listening to the crackle of dry leaves as the dead branches are engulfed in rising flames. I estimate the embers will last for days, glowing in the chill of the fall nights. I'll plan on going out daily to watch the fire, my face and arms warmed by the heat of the burning wood. Later, I'll plow the ashes back into the earth. The ground will be renewed, and I'll hope that my next orchard will be as rich. Are my Suncrest peaches obsolete? This, it seems, is my epitaph for a peach.
Two days after killing the turkey, clean it, cook it with salt. Turkey meat can be delicious, even exquisite, if the turkey has been fattened up properly. This can be accomplished by keeping the birds in clean pens with plenty of corn and water. 15 days before the turkey is to be killed, begin feeding it small walnuts. Start with one the first day. The next day, put two in its beak, and keep increasing the number this way until the night before it's to be killed, regardless of how much corn it voluntarily eats during this period. Tita took care to feed the turkeys properly. She wanted the feast to go well, for the ranch was celebrating an important event, the baptism of her nephew, first son of Pedro and Rosaura. This event warranted a grand meal with mole. She had had a special set of earthenware dishes made for the occasion with the name Roberto on them, for that is what they had named the beautiful baby, on whom all the family and friends were lavishing gifts and attention, especially Tita, who, contrary to what she had expected, felt an immense tenderness toward the boy, completely overlooking the fact that he was the product of her sister's marriage to Pedro, the love of her life. She was really excited as she started to prepare the mole the day before the baptism. Pedro, hearing her from the living room, experienced a sensation that was new to him. The sound of the pans bumping against each other, the smell of the almonds browning in the griddle, the sound of Tita's melodious voice singing as she cooked, had kindled his sexual feelings. Just as lovers know the time for intimate relations is approaching from the closeness and smell of their beloved, or from the caresses exchanged in previous love play, so Pedro knew from the sounds and smells, especially the sounds of the browning sesame seeds, that there was a real culinary pleasure to come. The almond and sesame seeds are toasted in a griddle. The chiles, anchos, with their membranes removed, are also toasted lightly so they don't get bitter. This must be done in a separate frying pan since a little lard is used. Afterward, the toasted chiles are ground on a stone along with almonds and sesame seeds. Tita, on her knees, was bent over the grinding stone, moving in a slow, regular rhythm, grinding the almonds and sesame seeds. Under her blouse, her breasts move freely, since she never wore a brassiere. Drops of sweat formed on her neck and ran down into the crease beneath her firm, round breasts. Pedro couldn't resist the smells from the kitchen and was heading toward them. But he stopped stock still in the doorway, transfixed by the sight of Tita in that erotic posture. Tita looked up without stopping her grinding, and her eyes met Pedro's. At once their passionate glances fused so perfectly that whoever saw them would have seen but a single look, a single rhythmic and sensual motion, a single trembling breath, a single desire. They stayed in this amorous ecstasy until Pedro lowered his eyes and stared steadily at Tita's breasts. She stopped grinding, straightened up, and proudly lifted her chest so Pedro could see it better. His scrutiny changed their relationship forever. After that penetrating look that saw through clothes, nothing would ever be the same. Tita knew through her own flesh how a fire transforms the elements, how a lump of corn flour is changed into a tortilla, how a soul that hasn't been warmed by the fire of love is lifeless, like a useless ball of corn flour. In a few moments' time, Pedro had transformed Tita's breasts from chaste to experienced flesh without even touching them. If it hadn't been for Chencha walking in, back from buying some chiles anchos, who knows what would have happened between Pedro and Tita? Well, perhaps Pedro would have ended up tirelessly caressing the breasts that Tita offered him. But unfortunately, that was not to be. Pedro pretended he'd come in for a glass of lime water with sage, quickly got it, and left the kitchen.
Sure, I will ever think of the term sesame seeds the same again. And now, Paul Huberty and Mo McElroy and Jacqueline Wells will be doing a little something from the movie Stranger Than Fiction by Zach Helm.
The bakery has shut down for the evening, save for a small area of the kitchen where Anna is transferring cookies from a sheet to a cooling rack. There are only a few lights on, and Anna works silently and peacefully. Harold comes out of the office, exhausted, carrying his briefcase, jacket, and pad. He stands for a moment and watches her.
Hi.
Hi.
Everyone's gone.
I know.
I made too much batter, so I'm baking off some cookies.
Where did all the other food go?
Well, we try to only make what we think we'll sell. The small amount left over we give to the shelter up the street.
Ah, I see. Well, good night.
He goes to leave. She looks after him.
You want a cookie?
Harold stops and thinks, but he's given up.
No.
Come on. They're warm and gooey, fresh out of the oven.
No, I don't like cookies.
You don't like cookies?
No.
What the f*** is wrong with you?
I don't like cookies.
Everybody likes cookies.
I just...
After a really awful, no good day, didn't your mother ever give you milk and cookies?
No. My mother couldn't bake. All the cookies I had were store-bought.
What about birthday cakes?
Store-bought.
Breakfast
muffins? Store-bought. Frozen, thawed in the oven.
Bake sale brownies?
Private school, no bake sales.
God. Well, that's probably what turned you into an evil government drone.
No, actually, I was kidnapped by gypsy accountants as a teenager.
She laughs.
Really? A nomadic tribe of abacus builders?
It's that same laugh. The wonderful, human, loving one from the bus. Suddenly she stops and looks at him. They stare at each other for a moment. Her lips part. His fingers twitch. Harold's watch looks on anxiously. The pad of paper reveals their lopsided fate. Comedy, 7. Tragedy, 114. Harold's watch waits. Then...
Okay. Sit down.
Oh, no, listen,
Sit down.
He sits on a stool across the butcher block from her. She goes to a cupboard and pulls out a glass and a plate. She goes to the refrigerator and pulls out a bottle of milk, then pours some into the glass. She brings the glass and the plate over to the block, places a single cookie on the plate, and places the plate in front of Harold.
Thank you. I couldn't...
Eat the cookie.
I really can't...
Eat the cookie.
Miss Pascal, it's...
It was a really awful, no good day. I know. I made sure of it. So pick up the cookie, dip it in the goddamn milk, and eat the thing.
She slides the plate closer to him. He cautiously takes the cookie, dunks it, and bites into it. His eyes light up. His shoulders relax. He breathes.
Wow, that's a really, really good cookie.
Once again, she suddenly stops and looks at him. They stare at each other for a moment. Her lips part. His fingers twitch. Harold's watch looks on anxiously. The pad of paper reveals their lopsided fate. Harold's watch waits. Then she takes the plate and goes to get him more cookies.
So, when did you decide to become a baker?
Oh, in college.
Oh, like cooking college?
No. I went to Harvard Law.
Oh, geez. I'm sorry. I just assumed. Sorry.
No, it's all right. I didn't finish.
She brings a plate with more cookies to Harold.
Did something happen?
Not really. I was barely accepted. I mean, barely. The only reason they let me come was because of my essay. How I was going to make the world a better place with my degree. And I went there thinking that, well, that I might make a difference. And, well, you know, Harvard Law has the smartest people in the world, people who will one day shape the earth. And it's competitive and vicious and exhausting. And I'd have to stay and participate in these all-night study sessions, classmates and I, all night long, sometimes for a couple days straight. And so
she trails off, staring into space again, unsure whether to proceed. Once again, she suddenly stops and looks at him. They stare at each other for a moment. Her lips part. His fingers twitch. Harold's watch looks on anxiously. The pad of paper reveals their lopsided fate. Harold's watch waits. Then, gently, Harold pushes the plate of cookies across to her. She looks at him, then at the plate. She sits down, picks up a cookie, then continues.
And so I would bake. Cookies, usually, so no one would go hungry while we worked. I'd bake all afternoon in the kitchen in the dorm before a big study session and write down what I was doing in one of those Black Me journals they sell by the gross in the campus bookstore. Mm-hmm. And I'd bring my little treats to the study groups, and people love them. Oatmeal cookies and peanut butter bars, chocolate chip and macadamia nut wedges. And everyone would eat and stay happy and study harder and do better on the tests. And more people would come to the study groups, and the study groups got better, and I would make more snacks and try to find better recipes. And the results would always get better and better. And soon it was cheese and apricot croissants and mocha bars with almond glaze and lemon chiffon cake with zesty peach icing. And our study groups were famous all around Cambridge. I mean, not because we had the most copious notes or the smartest people, but because we had the best snacks.
She gets up and goes to the cookie sheet and begins to remove the cookies and put them on a large paper plate. She yanks a strip of plastic wrap from the tube and wraps the larger plate of cookies.
And at the end of the spring term, well, I had 27 study partners, 8 Black Me journals filled with recipes, in a D average. So I dropped out. I mean, simply without alarm and without any regrets. I just figured if I was going to make the world a better place, I'd do it with cookies.
Harold stares at her, obviously enamored. She looks at his plate. There's only one cookie left.
I'm glad you liked them.
I did. Thank you for forcing me to eat them.
You're welcome.
They look at each other for a moment. Harold finds himself suddenly nervous. He looks at his watch.
Well, I should go. Thank you. Thanks again, I mean, for the cookies.
She takes a moment, then offers the larger plate.
Why don't you take them?
No.
No?
No, really, I can't.
No. Oh, okay.
I mean, I would, but, well, I can't.
You can't?
It constitutes a gift, and we're not allowed to accept gifts. I shouldn't have even had that first one.
Well, I'm not going to tell anyone.
Oh, I know, but if you did...
I'm not going to.
No, I know, but if you did, I could... Tell you what, I'll purchase them.
What? No, no, never mind. Just go home.
Well, I could just pay for them.
No, just go home.
But I really like them.
Just go home.
He stops. He gets his coat, picks up his briefcase, and heads for the door. He suddenly realizes and turns around.
You baked those cookies for me, didn't you?
Embarrassed, she simply shrugs.
You were trying to be nice to me, and I totally blew it.
She shrugs.
And that may very well be the last time you try to be nice again.
She looks at him, and then once more shrugs. He hangs his head. He pulls out his pad and his pen. He opens the pad and makes one last mark.
I know this will sound like gibberish to you, but I'm in a tragedy. And if I am in a tragedy, it's no one's fault but my own.
You're listening to a special holiday edition of Mouthful on KRCB.
And we're back. All right, and now a special guest star. We get to hear her on KRCB. We get to read her in the Press Democrat. She's written wonderful books. She's a dear friend and a brilliant woman when it comes to many, many things, and you should know this. She's an admitted hula dancer. Giving us something that she loves from our local friend, MFK Fisher, please welcome Michelle Anna Jordan.
Life and Death Among the Mollusks. An oyster leads a dreadful but exciting life. Indeed, his chance to live at all is slim, and if he should survive the arrows of his own outrageous fortune, and in the 2 weeks of his carefree youth find a clean, smooth place to fix on, the years afterwards are full of stress, passion, and danger. He. But why make him a he except for clarity? Almost any normal oyster never knows from 1 year to the next whether he is a he or a she. And may start at any moment after the first year to lay eggs where before he spent his sexual energies in being exceptionally masculine. If he is a she, her energies are equally feminine, so that in a single summer, if all goes well, and the temperature of the water is somewhere around 70 degrees, she may spawn several hundred million eggs with commendable pride. American oysters differ as much as American people, so that the Atlantic coast inhabitants spend their childhood and adolescence floating free and unprotected with the tides, conceived far from their mothers and their fathers too by milt let loose in the water near the eggs, while the Western oysters lie within special brood chambers of the maternal shell, inseminated and secure until they are some 2 weeks old. The Easterners seem more daring. A little oyster is born then in the water. At first, about 5 to 10 hours after he and at least a few hundred thousand of his mother's eggs have been fertilized by his potent and unknown sire, he is merely a larva. He is small, but he is free swimming. And he swims thus freely for about 2 weeks, wherever the tides and his peculiar whims may lead him. He is called a spat. It is to be hoped, sentimentally at least, that the spat, our spat, enjoys himself. Those 2 weeks are his one taste of vagabondage, of double-may-care free roaming. And even then, he is not quite free, for during all his youth, he is busy growing a strong foot and a large supply of sticky-like stuff. If he thought, he might wonder why. The 2 weeks up, he suddenly attaches himself to the first clean, hard object he bumps into. His 50 million brothers who have not yet been eaten by fish may or may not bump into anything clean and hard, and those who do not die. But our spat has been lucky. And in great good spirits, he clamps himself firmly to his home, probably forever. He is by now about 1/75th of an inch long, and he is an oyster. Since he is an Easterner, he has found a pleasant, moderately salty bottom where the tides wash regularly and there is no filth to pollute him and no sand to choke him. There he rests, tied firmly by his left foot, which seems to have become a valve in the immutable way of all oyster feet. He devotes himself to drinking and rapidly develops an envious capacity so that in good weather he can easily handle 26 or 27 quarts an hour. He manages better than most creatures to combine business with pleasure. And from the stream of water that passes through his gills, he strains out all the delicious little diatoms that are his food. Spatdom is over and done with. The two fine free-swimming weeks are gone forever. Maturity with all of its cares has come. An oyster, according to Richard Sheridan's critic, may be crossed in love. For about a year, this oyster, our oyster, is a male, fertilizing a few hundred thousand eggs as best he can without ever knowing whether they swim by or not. Then one day, maternal longings surge between his two valves in his cold guts and gills and all his crinkly fringes. Necessity, that well-known mother, makes him one. He is a she. From then on, she, with occasional vacations of being masculine just to keep her hand in, bears her millions yearly. She is in the full bloom of womanhood when she is about 7. She is a fine, plump figure of an oyster, plumper still in the summer when the season and her instincts get the better of her. She has traveled some, thanks to cupidinous farmers who have subjected her to this tide and that, this bed and that, for their own mean ends. She has grown into a gray-white oval shape with shades of green or black in her gills and a rudimentary brain in the forepart of her blind, deaf body. She can feel shadows as well as the urgency of milt, and her delicate muscles know danger and pull shut her shells with firmness. Danger is everywhere for her, and extermination lurks. She is the prey of many enemies and must lie immobile as a fungus while the white starfish sucks her and the worm bores. She has 8 enemies, not counting man, who is the greatest, since he protects her from the others, only to eat her himself. The first enemy is the starfish, which floats hungrily in all the eastern tides, and at last wraps arms around the oyster like a hideous lover and forces its shell apart steadily and then thrusts his stomach into it and digests it. The picture is ugly. The oyster is left bare as any empty shell, and the starfish floats on, hungry still. The second enemy, almost as dangerous, is a kind of snail called an oyster drill. It bores wee round holes in the shells and apparently worries the poor mollusk enough to make men invent traps for it. Wire bags baited with seed oysters catch it, but none too efficiently, since it remains a menace. Then there is a boring sponge. It makes tiny tunnels all through the shell like honeycomb until an oyster becomes thin and weak from trying to stop up all the holes, and then it is often smothered by the sponge from the outside, so that you know what Louisa May Alcott meant when she wrote, "Now I am beginning to live a little and feel less like a sick oyster at low tide." There are leeches and black drums. And mussels, too, will smother oysters or starve them by coming to stay on their shells and eating all their food. Out on the Pacific coast, slipper shells, which are somewhat fancily called Crepidula fornicata, will go the mussels one better. And even ducks, flying here and there as ducks must, land long enough to make themselves a disastrously good meal on an oyster bed. Life is hard, we say, and oyster's life is worse. She lives motionless, soundless, her own cold, ugly shape, her only dissipation. And if she escapes the menace of the duck, slipper, mussel, black drum, leech, sponge, borer, starfish, it is for man to eat because of man's own hunger. Men have enjoyed eating oysters since they were not much more than monkeys, according to the kitchen middens that they left behind. And thus, in their own one-minded way, they have spent time and thought and money on the problem of how to protect oysters from the suckers and the borers and the starvers, until now it is comparatively easy to eat this two-valved mollusk anywhere, without thought of the dangers it has run in its few years. its chilly, delicate gray body slips into a stew pan or under a broiler or alive down a red throat, and it is done. Its life has been thoughtless, but no less full of danger. And now that it is over, we are perhaps the better for it. This is from Consider the Oyster by M.F.K. Fisher, written in 1941 for Dilwyn Parish, who did not live to see its publication. Thank you.
You know, Mary Frances Kennedy Fisher lived in Glen Ellen and still leaves quite an impact with us when we think about what we eat and drink and when it's going to swim away and be eaten itself. Now we have visiting us Scott Peacock from Decatur, Georgia, and he's going to give us a little something that he'll introduce. Let's hear it for Scott Peacock visiting our community.
Several years ago, I met a gentleman who's now deceased named Eugene Walter. And Eugene Walter was from Alabama, as am I, originally. In the 70s, Time Life was doing a series of books on American cooking, and they hired Eugene to come back and visit the South for the first time in more than 20 years and write about it. And so he begins this journey, and he's talking about the South, and he explores different things. It really is a great book. So in this passage I'm going to read to you, he's talking about the South in general, but then he goes to visit a childhood friend of his now who now lives in Georgia to talk to her about what Southern food is and explain this project and get her insights onto this. So this is called Deep in the Heart of Dixie. On a summer evening some years ago, two of the South's most celebrated writers, William Faulkner and Catherine M. Porter, were dining together at a plush restaurant in Paris. Everything had been laid on to perfection. A splendid meal had been consumed, a bottle of fine Burgundy emptied, and thimble-sized glasses of an expensive liqueur drained. The maitre d' and an entourage of waiters hovered close by, ready to satisfy any final whim. "Back home, the butter beans are in," said Faulkner, peering into the distance. "The speckled ones." Miss Porter fiddled with her glass and stared into space. "Blackberries," she said wistfully. There was no need to say more. The Deep South is not just a geographical area that comprises the southernmost tier of the United States. It is an entire way of life, a state of mind, an emotional attachment that endures wherever else one may find oneself. As you journey into this region, there is a palpable difference. The landscape has an added lushness. You are moving towards the sun's home track. Sunrises and sunsets are less lingering, and you can smell the steaming earth. The passionate sense of life that goes with a hot climate is evident. Faces are seldom placid, but openly humorous or narrow-eyed with suspicion. All of the fascinating contradictions of an immensely complex region manifest themselves here. This is the land where the alligator dozes beneath the gentlest rose, where the uncommon coral snake idles beneath the commonplace oak. The pace of life and approach to life are different here. There is a kind of friendliness and civility that goes beyond ordinary manners. It is a take your time, sit down and enjoy yourself attitude that makes almost every encounter an experience. People are more outgoing, more amusing, and more amused. This is one place where the language is still alive, where talk is still one of life's principal pleasures, and when the talk is about food, it can be utterly beguiling. My first stop on this journey, back to my own roots, was at Macon, Georgia, where I had an invitation to visit an old friend, Miss Charlotte Wynn. When I turned into her street, Miss Charlotte was waiting on the front porch. She had divined the moment of my arrival. The long years of our separation vanished as if they had never been, and she led the way into her kitchen, a huge square room lined with large white tiles. In it were an ancient iron and enamel gas stove, and in the middle of the room a gray marble top table. Two windows opened onto the back porch where the family dines in warm weather, a kind of green grotto completely latticed, screened, and covered with asparagus fern. in short order of our conversation, turn to Miss Charlotte's favorite foods and cooking techniques. Well, if you're going to talk about Southern food, cornbread and things like that, she began, you have to insist on the importance of iron skillets. So saying, she glanced at a row of skillets in graduated sizes hanging against the tile wall under a shelf of pots and pans. These are all the old ones, but about 5 years ago, one of our big ones cracked and I had to replace it. I brought the new one home and cleaned it first with alcohol to get rid of the factory grease. Then I scrubbed it with a brush and soap and hot water. I never use abrasives or steel wool. The idea is to get it as smooth as black silk. Then I rubbed it with oil for a day or so and let it sit. After that, I filled it with potato peels and water and set it in a slow oven for a morning to temper. Then I scrubbed it again and oiled it some more. And after you use a skillet, you have to wash it carefully and dry it right away and oil it and put it away. If you take care of it, it will treat you right. Real cornbread can only be made when the skillet is greased with bacon fat and heated before you put the batter into it. I hope you're going to make some cornbread, I suggested, but she was already lining up other ingredients and had taken down a large skillet and was obviously setting about to make something else. Anybody worth 2 cents can make cornbread, but not everybody can make an upside-down cake, she laughed. The name alone always brings a smile, and when Yankees are joking, enviously, of course, about Southern food, they say compon, an upside-down cake, in a way we Southerners never talk. I watched her. This part of interior Georgia is famous cake country. The variety of cakes at fairs and church bazaars is astonishing. And Miss Charlotte is a great cake maker, but she hates sweet icings. Cavity finders, she says darkly, and she never uses confectioner's sugar, preferring unfrosted cakes that go well with black coffee. This skillet, when I feel it, with time it's developed a patina. I only touch a film of butter to it. And this is a very Southern thing. You go to someone's house and you're having dinner and they say, oh, Miss Peacock, this is the most delicious corn pudding. And say, oh, it's real easy. I'll give you the recipe. And then they give you the recipe at the table while you're talking. So never, ever. Do you understand? Okay. I take 1.5 cups of brown sugar dotted with little pea-sized bits of butter, maybe 2 tablespoons of butter in all, and spread this in the bottom of the skillet. On top of the sugar, I put pineapple, or sometimes, just as often as not, I put in thick slices of crisp apple or slices of sand pear, sliced pearwise. Then I beat up 1.5 cups of sugar and 3 eggs and add 1/2 cup of water and 1.5 cups of pastry flour and stir it all up. And finally, I put in 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of vanilla, the faintest pinch of allspice, and a pinch of salt. I pour this batter carefully into the pan over the fruit and sugar and bake it slowly for an hour. While we waited for the upside-down cake to bake, we sat in the green grotto and discussed the coffee that would go with it. Southerners like stronger, blacker coffee, Miss Charlotte said. I can't drink those weak brews that are like dishwater. I retch if I do. Maybe it's partially because of all the substitutes we had during the war. This was in the 70s, and she's not referring to World War II or or anything in Vietnam. This is the war. Also referred to as the War of Northern Aggression. And in the present today, sometimes in certain pockets. Maybe it's partially because of all the substitutes we had during the war. Like parched sweet potato peel, or parched this and parched that. I like it black and I like it strong. Also, maybe it's because very good coffee goes so well with our very sweet desserts. How could you get through one of those devastating, marvelous pecan pies unless you had the contrast of strong coffee? She went to her broom, plucked out a straw, and washed it under the hot tap and stuck it into the cake in the oven. A few minutes more and it'll be ready, she murmured. And now Miss Charlotte reveals a bit about her youth to us. I learned the secret of good coffee when I went to the Sorbonne for a year. Paris was full of Brazilians in those days. Before they were devalued or seized by a coup or whatever. And I noticed how they always drank coffee as a sleeping draught. My friend Carlos explained how they make it in coffee country. First of all, the blacker the coffee, the more that means it has been roasted and the caffeine has been almost cooked away. But the secret is in scouring the pot thoroughly the minute you've used it, but thoroughly. And once a week, you rub it with lemon and put it in the sun, and you leave it out open, all parts exposed. It's traces of yesterday's coffee that keep you awake at night, not freshly made, well-roasted coffee. The asparagus ferns around us reached all the way to the lattice ceiling. As we sat waiting for the cake, small, light green lizards put their heads out to peer at us. "Lizard, lizard, show your money bag," said Miss Charlotte, as we had all done when we were children. The lizard she addressed obediently puffed out the bright rose-colored air sacs on each side of his head. They hate the radio, but if I whistle "Summertime" or "Deep Purple," they put their heads out and wave them from side to side. By now, the kitchen was full of spicy baking smell, and Miss Charlotte took the skillet from the oven and turned it upside down on a serving plate. The rich, dark, golden brown cake emerged with the yellow pineapple slices glistening on top. She busied herself making coffee, and we then went to work on the cake. It was a magnificent organization of sugary sogginess, pineapple sweetness, and warm spiciness.
I will tell you that this essay was written by David Sedaris, and shortly after this essay, he and his partner moved to Paris. It is his birthday, and Hugh and I are seated in a New York restaurant awaiting the arrival of our 15-word entrees. He looks very nice, dressed in the suit and sweater that have always belonged to him. As for me, I own only my own shoes, my pants, my shirt, and tie. My jacket belongs to the restaurant and was offered as a loan by the maitre d', who apparently thought I'd feel more comfortable dressed to lead a high school marching band. I'm wearing the thick gold braids decorating my sleeve when the waiter presents us with what he calls a little something to amuse the palate, roughly the size and color of a Band-Aid. The amusement floats on a shallow, muddy puddle of sauce and is topped with a sprig of greenery. And this would be what exactly, Hugh asks. This, the waiter announces, is our raw Atlantic swordfish served in a dark chocolate gravy and garnished with fresh mint. Not again, I say. Can't you guys come up with something a little more less conventional? Love your jacket, says the waiter. I've had that waiter. As a rule, I'm no great fan of eating out in New York restaurants. It's hard to love a place that has outlawed smoking but finds it perfectly acceptable to serve raw fish in a bath of chocolate. There are no normal restaurants left, at least in our neighborhood. The diners have all been taken over by precious little bistros boasting a menu of indigenous American cuisine. They call these meals traditional, yet they're rarely American dishes that I remember. The patty melt has been pushed aside in favor of urban-crusted medallions of baby artichoke hearts, which never leave me thinking, oh, right, those. I wonder if they're as good as the one that Mom used to make. Part of the problem is that we live in the wrong part of the town. Soho is not a macaroni salad kind of place. This is where, I love this part, this is where, I can't do this without laughing, this is where the world's brightest young talents come to braise caramelized racks of corn-fed songbirds or offer up their famous knuckle of flash-seared crappy served with a collar of chided ginger and cornered by a tribe of kiln-roasted Chilean toadstools. Teased with a warm spray of clarified musk oil. Even when they promise something simple, they've got to tart it up. The meatloaf has been poached in seawater. Or there are figs in the tuna salad. If cooking is an art, I think we're in our dada phase. I've never really thought of myself as a particularly finicky eater, but it's hard to be a good sport when each dish seems to include no fewer than a dozen ingredients, one of it which I'm bound to dislike. I'd order a steak with a medley of suffocated peaches, and I'm put off by the aspirin sauce. The sea scallops look good until I'm told they're served in a broth of malt liquor and mummified lychee nuts. What I really want is a cigarette. And I'm always searching the menu in hope that some courageous young chef has finally recognized tobacco as a vegetable. Bake it, steam it, grill it, or stuff it into little neck clams. I just need something familiar that I can hold on to. When the waiter brings our entrees, I have no idea which plate might be mine. In yesterday's restaurants, it was possible to both visualize and recognize your meal. There were always subtle differences, but for the most part, a lamb chop tended to maintain its basic shape. That is to say, it looked chop-like. It had a handle made of a bone and a teardrop of meat hugged by a thin rind of fat. Apparently, though, that was too predictable. Order the modern lamb chop, and it's likely to look no different than your companion's order of shackled pompano. The image is painful. The current food is always arranged into senseless vertical towers. No longer content to recline, it now reaches for the sky. Much like the high-rise buildings lining our city streets. It's as if the plates were valuable parcels of land and the chef had purchased one small lot and unlimited air rights. Hugh's saffron linguine resembled a miniature turban topped with architectural spires of shrimp. It stands there in the center while the rest of the vast empty plate looks as though it's been leased out as a possible parking lot. I'd ordered the steak, which, bowing to the same minimalist fashion, is served without the bone, the thin slices of beef stacked to resemble a funeral pyre. The potatoes I'd been expecting have apparently either been clarified to an essence or were used to stoke the grill. Maybe, Hugh says, they're inside your tower of meat. This is what we've been reduced to. Hugh blows the yucca pollen off his blackened shrimp while I pull back the sleeves of my borrowed sport coat and search the meat tower for my promised potatoes. There they are, right there. Hugh uses a fork to point out what could easily be mistaken for 5 cavity-riddled molars. The dark spots must be my vegetable. Because I am both a glutton and a masochist, my standard complaint, "That was so bad," is always followed by, "And there was so little of it." Our plates are cleared and we are presented with dessert menus. I learned that spiced ham is no longer considered just a luncheon meat, and that even back issues of the Smithsonian can be turned into sorbet. "I just couldn't," I say to the waiter when he recommends the white chocolate and wild loganberry couscous. "If we're counting calories, I could have the chef serve it without the creme fraiche." "No," I say, "really, I couldn't." We ask for the check, explaining that we have a movie to catch. It's only a 10-minute walk to the theater, but I'm antsy because I'd like to get something to eat before the show. They'll have loads of food at the concession stand, but I don't believe in mixing meat with movies. Luckily, there's a hot dog cart not too far along the way. Friends always say, "How can you eat those? I read in the paper that they're made from hog's lips." And? And hearts and eyelids. That, to my mind, is only 3 ingredients. And constitutes a refreshing change of pace. I ordered mine with nothing but mustard, and I'm thrilled to watch the vendor present my hot dog in a horizontal position. So simple and timeless that I can recognize it immediately as food.
Table Talk was produced by Clark Wolf and Mo McEnroe as part of the Russian River Food and Wine Festival. It was directed by Jacqueline Wells as a benefit for Pegasus Theater. Actors from Pegasus Theater were Paul Huberty, Mo McEnroe, Andrea Van Dyke, Lois Perlman, Steve Fowler, and Jacqueline Wells. Michelle Anna Jordan and Scott Peacock were special guests.
Thanks for tuning in. I will see you next week on KRCB at 7 o'clock for another tasty episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Have a great week.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.